Listeners, I am excited to share with you an industry leader and someone who has certainly been one of the top individuals I've respected over the years when it comes to executive leadership, management. He's had a stellar career in the industry. And I was recently with Cindy Smaney, one of my dear friends, a mutual friend of who you're going to listen to in just a minute. And I asked her, of all the bosses you've had, who has impressed you the most? And she came back and she said, there is one that stands out. I've had many good ones, but one stands out head and tails above all the others. His name is Tony Meola. So informally known as Anthony Meola, but to the industry, he is known as Tony Meola. Tony, I want to welcome you to Lickin' on Leadership. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You have a management style that is legendary. It's led to many successes and I'm sure some challenges along the way. But first, let's start with this. How long have you been in the industry?
Well, you know, if you sum it all up, a 30-year career, I've been in the business world for 40 years. The first 10 I spent at Amerada Hess in the oil industry, believe it or not. And then through fortune on a project with Citibank, and Citibank hired me as their mortgage strategic planner. And at that time, interstate banking was just coming around. This is really dated, but it's back in the 80s. They were going into the tri-state area and they wanted someone to plan out how they would get Connecticut and New Jersey and New York as one market, which was allowable for the first time in there. And that's what I did.
Very good. So you came into it, would you say accidentally or intentionally? It sounds like somewhat accidentally.
Well, you know, it was, I would say it was fortuitous, but yeah, by accident. I was in finance. That's where I started my career. And I was a controller at Amerada Hess in marketing. We had put in the first ATMs in Long Island with Citi. On that project, the Citi exec noticed me, picked me out and said, hey, look, we're going to start this thing called a mortgage business. It's going to be the first interstate banking capability along with credit card. And we need some people to plan this out. And he was impressed with my planning skills in that project. And I didn't know much about mortgage at that time, but I went into it. And then I think what happened was the boom of the 1986 era there when mortgages really took off. Secondary marketing came in. So I learned the industry as the industry learned itself.
Yeah. Formative times, high development time, a lot of rapid changes in the industry. But when you look over your career, so our listeners, I want to get into leadership, which is what this is about and what's molded your career. But before we do that, you went from Citi. How did you go through the various companies that you worked at? Give us a little bit of your journey through the mortgage industry.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think about when I think about leadership is the ability to learn from your experiences and then assimilate those. So when I think of my journey, it's interesting because at Amerada Hess, before I even entered into the mortgage, it was my first job out of college. And it was a very disciplined structure. You know, it was a very rank has its privileges. The culture was very control oriented. So I learned about discipline from Hess. And then when I went to Citi Mortgage and the ability to do the strategic plan and then execute it and then continue on in that organization, I really learned the value of being well thought out. So thinking of not only the current impact of what you're doing, but what's after that and how does it fit into your whole, you know, goals, first in the industry, but then secondly, personally, I began to assimilate some of that learning to me personally. Why wouldn't I think about two or three steps for my own career versus thinking about two or three steps for the mortgage business at Citi? And I learned a lot about operating discipline at Citi. So those two things really gave me foundation, being well thought out and understanding operating discipline and its values. From there, I went to PNC, and PNC really is the core of the foundation that I built for myself as a leader. I worked for a tremendous leader at the time in a guy named Cy Nockvi.
Oh, yes.
And Cy taught me the values of a culture and how to really create a mindset in a company. Those things weren't things that, you know, I normally thought about or the value of those. Those things like culture and mindset, we look at those as soft type of skills or soft type of discipline. They are key to establishing anything, as I learned at PNC and then throughout my career there. But for Cy, I first began to think about a concept called the true north. What is my true north? What do I do best? What are the things that I want to go and do, and how does that manifest itself, you know, every day? And then from there, PNC was sold to Washington Mutual, and you want to talk about learning about something. Washington Mutual, I learned the power of a brand. Yeah. I learned the power of a brand both internally and externally, and I never realized the internal power of a brand. What I mean by that is this. As a leader, everything you do is under a microscope. It's viewed. It's digested by your followers. And as we acquired other companies at Washington Mutual, one of the key things was to establish our culture. And what I realized is the connectivity of all the things that you do, your meetings, your business reviews, your product launches. Every time you get to speak to your employees, every time you get to interact, you are either reinforcing a common culture or you are hurting a common culture inadvertently by not understanding your moment is a public moment. So at Washington Mutual, I coined a phrase in my leadership and my management system that said, what I think about, I talk about, I bring about. If you think about those three things, being well thought out, being able to articulate what your thoughts are, and being able to execute along those paths, that think about, talk about, and bring about became a mantra of mine, and it really shaped my ability to manage folks. And then from there, I went to what I think was the best and worst time of my career, having tremendous success. You can imagine a pretty good success run that I had. I was a chief operating officer at PNC. At Washington Mutual, I was the first acquired company leader to sit at their leadership table.
Wow.
So
knowing that company as well as I do, that is, I don't know if people could appreciate just how unusual that was. They did not usually keep.
At the time, we were the first. And, you know, it was interesting because you had that run and you feel invincible. And you're getting further and further away from the concept of knowing your own vulnerability. Because you're too enamored with all your successes and all the things that you do right, and you keep pursuing those things to grow them and nurture them. And in New Century, I got a call from a recruiter who was hired by the board of directors, who realized, the board of directors did, that New Century was in trouble. And they realized that my reputation in the industry at the time was a strong turnaround leader. And they asked me if I wanted to join New Century. And the challenge of joining New Century, understanding they were in trouble, understanding the economic crisis had just begun, but no one knew the depth of it, I thought, yeah, why not? This will be great. This will be my next, you know, victory. Never did I do the due diligence I needed to think through. Where was this going? All of those disciplines that had sort of got me to where I was, I didn't use any of them to make a New Century decision. I just looked at, you know, New Century as the dragon, and I was the ultimate dragon slayer. So sure, I'll take the job. And what happened? Well, the dragon got me. So,
do I appreciate that transparency, Tony. You had a thought. I wanted to let you complete that, but I want to dwell on that because I think there's some really good points out of that, and I want to talk about the Washington Mutual, the brand, and some aspect. You're bringing out some really good points that we want to pause and go back on. But I really appreciate your transparency about the New Century. I knew that one well. They were in the same town, Irvine, where we were, California, and Southern California. They're one of the kings. We were one of the kings of the subprime space. We're doing extremely well. We are retail. They were out buying a lot of the product, and they did many things well. And there's still some things that they approached, business approaches, which I think when it comes to the wholesale model actually would work. When you're in a particular new experimental product is what I refer to it, at least I refer to that on television. I was being interviewed on this topic about the subprime, where this whole thing went. And I want to get more of, you said you skipped over some of the normal due diligence that you do. And it was a moment of, would you say, overconfidence or just feeling confident? Is trying to allow new leaders to learn from this because it's so valuable.
Well, look, I think that, to answer you directly, was overconfidence. But let's take a step back for a moment as a leader. Yeah. And, you know, as a leader, you have a set of data inputs that keep coming at you and a set of conditions. And one of the things that happens to leaders is they begin to look at their challenges of their leadership or of their capabilities. They begin to look at those challenges in a negative fashion, and they begin to fight those challenges. So when the challenge comes, normally leaders go combative and defeat the challenge. And they're then rewarded by, wow, what a great leader. They were challenged and they defeated the challenge. I began to think of it a little bit differently, you know, after New Century. And what I began to think about was something that I've termed positive intent, which is, let's say that you viewed the world as positive intent, meaning that people who talk to you actually wanted you to become better. They weren't out to get you, hurt you, jump you in the corporate ladder. Suddenly, when an auditor comes in your office and says, you have a problem in this area, if you look at it positive intent, you want to know about the problem. You want to fix the problem. You want to take advantage of that skill set that the auditor has. If I look at it with negative intent, I want to defeat the auditor. And that's just an example of sort of what you begin to learn. So it wasn't that, you know, overconfidence, it feels like a negative term to people. But the problem, the overconfidence is simply this. It's simply focusing in one area of a pie chart of your capabilities and your professional life. It's just focusing on one area and not focusing on the whole picture. Now, all of a sudden, overconfidence looks a little different to you. Yeah. It isn't some negative, it's just an area of focus. And when people focus, as I did, I focused on my career and the turnaround and my successes. And I said, boy, those successes, I can assimilate. I have been successful in a couple of companies. So yeah, New Century, sure, I could go in and turn that company around. What I didn't focus on at that time was, what are the other factors, the economic conditions?
Yeah.
And, you know, where was the housing market at the time? What were the challenges that brought New Century to this point? Those types of things that, if you go back to my management mantra, what you think about, right, you talk about, you bring about, I didn't think deep enough on that decision. And look, I mean, it could have easily turned some other way with a break here or there, but where would that break here or there come from? It would have to come externally, and I didn't give enough focus on the external situation at that time. So that, to me, you know, people talk about overconfidence, and folks told me, they said, you shouldn't go to New Century. That place is, you know, it's in a lot of trouble, and there you go with the challenges, right? And my mindset was, I'll defeat these challenges. Now, if I thought, geez, this person's really telling me this from a situation of positive intent, I would have listened a little bit more. And that's really what I think.
That's a good point. Stress that one more time. So if the person who was trying to give you their perspective, whether right or wrong, on that, was, if you could have perceived it, or if they were in fact giving it, is it the fact that they weren't giving it that way, or how you were perceiving it at the time, would you say?
Well, I'm biased here. I'm going to tell you, it's total reception. It's totally on you. Because you... people could say anything they want to you. How you take it in and digest it and internalize it is totally up to you. Positive intent is not an easy thing to do. When I say, you know, your listeners can't say, okay, tomorrow, starting tomorrow, I'm going to be everything positive intent. It doesn't work like that. You have emotional barriers. You have intellectual barriers that you have built up over time. You know, we all don't like that certain guy in the office who comes in our office to tell us something, right? And I always used to say to my direct reports, and those that will be listening on this podcast will know, I used to say to them, that auditor, that regulator, that peer in your office who's telling you something you don't want to necessarily hear, think about it as if they were telling you a way to get the biggest bonus and success that you'll have in your life. Because by addressing their issue, that's what will happen. You can only, if someone comes in and tells you, or some auditor or regulator or superior tells you something about yourself that is a weakness, and you solve for that weakness, then you become a better person. If you discuss with the person the weakness to a point where they say, geez, you know, I get it, you're really not weak in that area, but you were perceived that way, you've been able to change your perception. There is no negative outcome to really listening to sort of what people classify in their own mind as their enemy. You know, there really isn't.
Yep. Having made that mistake, if it was a mistake. I think oftentimes our most difficult places are our biggest growing places as well, because I think when we have a good trajectory in our careers, and I'm thinking about all the young leaders that are coming up, I'm actually thinking of several that are in companies right now that I'm consulting to, and I look at some that are very successful trajectory, and it's what they don't know or what they fail to understand. That's why we're doing these podcasts, is so this young next generation can hear you say the things you have, Tony, already that are so positive. And I think it's looking at things with positive intent in receiving and taking it in. Again, whether they meant it that way or didn't mean it that way, what you're saying is receive it as a positive, turn it to a positive, look at it that way, which really gets down to a SWOT analysis: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats.
Exactly.
I think when you look at a true SWOT, I think it's so critical for that. It is just, I could spend all day just on that one venture. There's so many lessons. But you went from New Century, you went on to Morgan Stanley. You were the chief executive officer of Saxon Mortgage, a company that I did a lot of business with. Talk about that and the things that, facet also, I want to mix in what you said about what Cy brought to you as culture. I love that topic. And because I see so many companies, you know, it was Drucker that said, you know, culture eats strategy for lunch. I think both are important, yeah. But love to have you comment about, mix that in as you talk about Morgan Stanley and your successes there.
Well, you know, there was no better petri dish for culture for me than Morgan Stanley, because at Morgan Stanley, I was brought in to rationalize their various mortgage businesses. They had about four of them. And the management team had brought me in to rationalize that, create a new way forward post-crisis. And what we did is I looked at the businesses and we picked out Saxon, which was a servicer that they had purchased.
Yep.
And we went ahead and made Saxon sort of the core. We shed the origination capability and we went into what is known in the industry as subservicing. And the idea behind Saxon was to create a company that would flourish in the crisis and then we would sell the company. And, you know, I remember my first meeting. We didn't have many employees at the time. I think we had probably about 500 employees. And I remember my first meeting with management, and I said, okay, you know, I'll be going down to Texas. I'll be assuming the helm of Saxon. I said, and I'm going to go over the strategy with the people. And I said, I'm going to tell them that we're going to build a great company and we're going to sell it. And that's how we're going to achieve success. And the looks around the boardroom when I said that, I knew I had said something terribly wrong in their estimation. And they said, you can't tell these people we're going to sell the company. And I said, well, if that's our goal, if that's our true north, we want everyone to be aboard with that and to be cognizant of that. And it was a real debated discussion. And, you know, you got to love the Wall Street crowd, because they basically said to me, well, it's on you. If you go down and fail, it's on you. And that's the way you want it. Right? Who else would you want it to be on?
Yeah.
So they were trying, as I go back to sort of the positive intent, I could view that as a threat. Oh, if I fail, they're gonna fire me. Well, of course, anybody who fails is gonna be, you know, considered, you know, for termination, I'm sure. But
exactly.
What I thought of is how important this has to be for these people, this concept. What about telling people your true goals?
Love it.
What are the vulnerabilities of that? And that's what I thought about on that plane ride. I didn't think about, I was right, I won. I didn't think about, maybe I'll switch it. All I thought about is the pros and cons of telling an organization exactly what you want to get done, even if it's intuitively in counter to folks.
Yeah.
So at Saxon, we came up with a set of values and an approach, and the mantra that we all aligned around was, we are going to create value in everything we do, and that value would be value that Morgan Stanley would recognize and have a tough time parting with, and Bitter would recognize and have a tough time trying to get from Morgan Stanley. And the culmination of it would be almost a bidding war on our value and a quantification of what we could create together. And everybody bought into that. And every place we went, everything we did, people would use that phrase. Our call centers, our agents on the call lines would say, how can I create value for you today? You know, it was a more than a mantra, it became a culture. But I want to go back to what you think about, talk about, bring about. So we think about that. We talk about how it's going to be present in all of our management meetings and all of our management discussions. Then the next thing we do is we begin to talk about it with our people. So every meeting we had, we would say, how's this going to create value for the client? How's this going to create value for Morgan Stanley? How's this going to create value for our employees? That simple. And there was a little three block. I'll never forget, somebody said to me, we've got to come up with a fourth block. And I said, why? They said, because there's no such thing as a three blocker. And I laughed. And I said, well, I don't know what to tell you, but we only have three things we're going to do. We're going to create value for the client, we're going to create value for ourselves, and we're going to create value for Morgan Stanley. I said, you guys want to come up with a fourth thing, I'm open, but that's it. And that's what we did. And it was a fantastic run. We ran the company.
Great story.
3,000 people. They actually, Morgan Stanley actually kept it. They didn't sell it. They kept it too long, unfortunately. The crisis turned against them later, you know, decade of 2010. But it was a phenomenal run. And folks from that organization always call me, ping me, email me on how well run that organization was. And the fact of the matter was, and I appreciate the compliment, but the fact of the matter was they were part of running it. And that's what made it so good.
Well, but you brought the leadership. And I think the fact that you're the transparency, which, again, what bonded me to our mutual friend, Cindy Smaney, is her transparency. She's such a transparent, real person, yet so powerful as an executive. And I think that you guys had that in common. That's why you work so well together. But I think that transparency, you going down there, why would I be anything but honest with them? But how you turned that into a positive intent was so good. And it was such a success story. But when you look at someone holds on to, like in their case, they did hang on to it for too long and it ended up not being good for them. Talk to that. When should we hold them and when should we fold them, Tony? That's Texas talk.
Oh, boy, that's a question for the ages, right? But here's what I think happens to companies that have that bell curve experience.
Yes.
There's a point in the company where they step away from their culture. They step away from who they are. They step away sort of from their values. And you could pick out any company. When Bank of America bought Countrywide, they sort of stepped away from who they were.
Yes.
And that was manifested by the fact that Countrywide's management team ran that division of Bank of America called the mortgage division. The entire management team ran it. So it wasn't they just picked a couple of people. They just supplemented Countrywide into their and now they had two cultures or three cultures.
Right.
And you know, the thing is, when you begin to step away from who you are, then I think that becomes part of the issue, because the talent that you bring in and the environment that you've created begins to deteriorate and crumble. So when you look at the Saxon example, when Morgan said, we are going to hold this, that was the beginning of the end, because Morgan isn't a company that holds stuff.
That's not who they are.
You know, it's funny, because vulnerability is only a problem until you admit it and address it. If you admit vulnerability, you're more than halfway there to never be hurt by it. And I think that's the problem with companies, and it's the problem with individuals, is they don't think enough about their vulnerabilities. One of the people that I think does that better than anyone in today's world of big banks and Wall Street is Brian Moynihan, my former boss of Bank of America. He understands vulnerability, and he understands how to protect against his and the companies and his employees. So it's a real, I think, focus. And any time you look at any of the rise and falls, GE, you know, any of them, you find that in some way and some form, they stepped out of who they were. Maybe the market pressured them, maybe earnings pressures, you know, CAGR, you know, those things, those metrics. pressure people. That's sort of how subprime got into just about every company it got into. Yep. If you look at the history, they were all small companies and somebody bought them. And, you know, look at what happened with Wachovia. Look what happened with Chase. Look what happened with Boston Mutual. Oh, okay. You know, any of those companies. But you step away from the core of who you are, you're vulnerable. And if you don't address it, that's what happens.
That's such a good point. Boy, there's so much. You talked about Bike America. That's where you're at today. You started out in the U.S. Consumer Operations. You were a U.S. Consumer Operations Executive, rather. And then you now have Enterprise Share Services Executive. Talk about a little bit about that, and then we're going to get into our leadership questions for you.
Sure. Well, let me just say that I am retiring from Bank of America after 40 years in the industry, and I'm going to dedicate the next chapter of my life to doing some more impactful and significant kinds of things. So I'm doing some executive coaching now. I'm doing public speaking. I'm doing some work with some universities on diversity, which is a passion of mine. So I'm sort of now having had a very successful and very rewarding, self-rewarding run for 40 years. I'll be stepping out. But Bank of America has been a phenomenal experience for me. It is really an interesting bank. Under Brian's leadership, the bank really is addressing some of the toughest issues from the industry and from itself. You know, Brian was one of the first to take away all the fees before regulators, you know, came in, et cetera. He really has a true north of helping clients achieve their financial dreams. And that is what he's all about. And that's what attracted me to Bank of America, was really Brian and the leadership team that he had assembled. You know, I always ask myself the question, you know, why do I exist? You know, what am I here to do? You know, and I really would, if your listeners have to answer that question for themselves, why do you exist? And they really genuinely think about it. It's a very difficult answer. The first three or four responses are incorrect. I'll just tell you that. You've got to drill deep into that pyramid to find out what's at the base. And I think, you know, for me, the thing that I enjoy the most in life is helping people achieve goals. That's the thing, yeah. I enjoy the most.
I live for that. I agree.
And it goes back to when you're a kid and you're on a team and you want to be the captain of the team because you want to help that team and you think you have ideas that could help it, you know? Or if you just want to be the captain so you can be popular, that's not really who you are. You want something else. You want popularity. So you really have to understand that. And for me, Bank of America gave me a platform. At the time I joined it, 2011, 55% of its portfolio in mortgages was delinquent. And it was one of the greatest problems in the financial crisis is how are you going to deal with 2.5 million people who are about to lose their home, and what could you do to help them? So it was a natural thing for me. That's what I love to do. For me, saving someone's home brought a satisfaction level and a feeling to me that, you know, it's unsurpassed.
Yeah.
And when I look at that, I got to do it 2 million times.
So
it's
amazing.
It's a phenomenal thing. So the Bank of America just gave me the opportunity to take all of the previous experiences that I've had, learning from those experiences, and assimilate those learnings into one place against one problem, against one dragon that I could go try to slay again.
Yeah.
And it really taught me about lateral thinking. You know, it's something Cy used to talk about.
Explain that, lateral thinking. Explain that a little bit.
You know, most of us view our lens is a vertical lens that's narrow and deep relative to the things that sort of are in front of us. Lateral thinking, it challenges us to think about all of the disciplines that occur in a particular thing. So for me, when I think about lateral thinking as applied to, say, my Bank of America experience, I had 2.5 million customers that needed relief in the mortgage process. So I could have said, okay, we're going to go, you know, do X. But I had to consider the investors, the shareholders, the regulators, risk, I had to consider something that is, that when I say it, is people sort of scratch their head. And I remember many times having discussed with borrowers, I had to think about it in an equitable sense for people. So if I did something in your mortgage to help you stay in your home, and the next person came in, I had to be true to my discipline and my values. What did I do for you? Can I do it here? And, you know, you had to be equitable in that, in fair lending. And fair lending really was something that I viewed prior to Bank of America as a regulation, and post Bank of America as a sort of a way to lend that is beyond the regulation. It's beyond, you know, when you have to adjudicate fair lending, you got a problem, okay?
Right.
You really
right.
shouldn't have to do that. But so lateral thinking is taking all of the impacts of something and putting those into your decision-making thought process versus that which you're only accountable, responsible for.
That's such a good story, and I love the positive intent and how you led that. Can you give us some great stories out of that? Did you hear from people? Now, you're at an executive level, and I think a lot of executives feel like, I don't have the impact at the consumer level. Your leadership had a direct impact on the lives of 2.5 million people. How did you connect with that? How did that motivate you? Were there specific stories? I remember meeting Angelo Mazzello in his office one time, and in the middle of his coffee table in his desk in his sitting area, there was a binder that had all these stories of people that wrote them, and he literally got emotional when he talked about those. And it was a part of the story. Again, that all ended up inside of Bank of America and a part of this colossal mess. But how did you connect to motivate yourself? Did you get in and listen to the stories? How close to the stories of the 2.5 million people did you get to? Obviously, not all 2.5 million could you get to, but how did you connect to that?
There were a couple of ways. First and foremost, I want to go back, and I don't want to sound like a broken record here, but I want to go back to what you think about, you talk about, you bring about.
Yeah.
And when I first looked at that, I thought about those people. I sat down and I thought about what they're going through, what they're faced. And then I thought, in their interaction with the bank, what could go wrong? What could go right? And I thought through that. And I didn't think through it alone, by the way. I took my management team into a conference room, and I would pose these questions to them. I would say, look, you know, what do we have to be worried about when folks call in? What do we have to be worried about on our processes? This is the most important and significant thing in their life, their home, their family. There's so much emotion attached to it. How are we going to deal with this? Mm. And we talked about it quite a bit. And then what I did is I really engaged with the frontline employees in focus groups, in individual meetings, and really tried to understand from our employees' perspective what they were going through. Think about an employee who the only thing they deal with is people losing their homes. Every single customer. Yeah. They do 30, 40 calls a day of people on the other end of that phone that are losing their homes. And they've got to go through that day. And you've got to help them get through that day with tools and enablement. Now, on the flip side, to get close to the consumer, once a month, which doesn't sound like a lot, I would let the calls come into my office directed into my... Now, as a senior executive, believe me, every senior executive out there knows this, your admin, you've got a whole sort of gate around you that people have to enter into it. It's tough to get by, you know?
Yep.
So I would tell my presidential group that handled complaints that came to my office, for one day a month, I cleared my calendar, and I said to my admin, let the phones in. And I talked to people. I talked to them who are going through that exact crisis. I listened to the tears in their voice. I empathized with them. You know, I grew up in a town right outside of Newark, New Jersey in the 60s. I grew up in a poor family. My dad had passed away when I was a toddler. My mother raised three kids as a widow, and we were poor. I mean, there's no other way I could say it. But I learned about what that meant and what that could be. And that helped me help these people quite a bit because I understood, you know, they would say to me, I would kind of laugh to myself. They'd say, you don't know what it's like. And I didn't say, yes, I do, and tell my story, because that's not what they wanted to hear. Okay. Because I didn't want to hear that when I was in that kind of a situation. I didn't want to hear somebody tell me, oh, yeah, well, I had it tough too. Well, it doesn't help me. So it helped me focus. Getting those calls help me understand, and they also help me with solutions. They also help me come up with input to our programs, because people would say to me, look, I can't pay you every month because next month I have the tuition for my son's grammar school, but I could pay you the next month. And then I thought, geez, if we had a program where folks could pay and not have to pay every month, what would that look like? And people would look at me and say, you know, that's crazy, you know. And I said, let's just go down that path and say, what would that look like, you know? And we then brought us to what we called step payments, you know. So there's a lot of things that if you can articulate, if you can talk about the problem, you could bring about the solution, because you surround yourself with a lot smarter people than you are around these topics, and you mm-hmm. draw from those. I think great managers are more like orchestra leaders than they are like musicians. You know, an orchestra leader doesn't necessarily know how to play every instrument in that orchestra, but they know how to, when to bring in the violins, when to bring in the bass,
yes,
how to use
great
the
analogies.
Horns. And that's what a great manager or leader is able to do. They're able to look and they're able to pull out and synthesize, you know, in an alignment, what their leadership team is doing. And that creates a very powerful leadership team.
I love it. There's so much there in this interview already, but I want to come to this question. How do you define leadership with all your experience? You're retiring, you're now going out. And if someone said, Tony, stellar career, how do you define leadership? What's your response?
You know, you may be disappointed in this, Dave. I have a very simple definition of leadership, and that is leaders create followership. Leaders are people that other people want to follow. If it's not about the ideologies, it's not about your pursuit or your goals. That's important, and that makes, you know, that impacts leaders. But the fact and only fact that defines a leader is people with followers. So then you say, if you look at that definition, you say, what makes a person, what characteristics exist that other people would actually want to follow them? And as you look at great leaders, you know, there's a number of attributes that they all have in common. And I think that self-awareness is at the top of that list. Leaders that are aware at all times, in all moments, of who they are, that they're the leader, those are some of your best leaders. As crazy as that sounds, you got to think about that. But if you're aware that you're the leader in every moment, you will become a magnificent leader.
That's so good.
Looking ahead, we've both been in this industry for over 40 years, and as we look ahead, what do you think the challenges are facing the leaders of today and tomorrow?
Well, look, I think that the challenge facing the leaders of both today and tomorrow are the same types of challenges that face our past leaders, and that is the world and its influences continue to change on people.
Right.
And leaders, to remain relevant, have to understand what those influences are, and they have to be able to incorporate those differences into their leadership style. So, you know, when you think about, you know, 20 years ago as an example, and what leaders faced from their, what did they face from their challenges, how to relate to a new population that was using new technologies like TVs and telephones, and how to incorporate those things to remain relevant in communicating. Because remember, you have to get your message across to be a leader.
Yes.
People want to follow you because they understand who you are. So I think today's challenges for leaders is the diversity mm-hmm. of followers is becoming greater and greater and greater. Look, I've done some great work with diversity. It's a passion of mine. But the reality is, going back to your vulnerability, you've got to know when you're vulnerable and when you're not, and you've got to shore up that. So at Bank of America, when I had a population of 67,000 people that reported to me, and 55% of those people were women, I had to get women leaders to tell me how to run that because as good as I am, I could not understand firsthand those types of struggles. Now, I had watched that kind of a struggle, even watching growing up. My mother was the breadwinner in my house. I knew what that was like, how difficult that was. But to relate to it in a manner that is optimal, you had to have women leaders. So 50% of my leadership team were women.
Oh,
and
I love it.
That helped me become the leader I became because I began to explore my diversity. I want to go back to something. People look at diversity today in many different ways, but I'm going to go back to what I said very beginning of this meeting, positive intent.
Yeah.
Suppose the best way for you to be successful is really to have a diverse team. You should explore that. You should think about that for a second. And you should think about the consequences of not having a diverse team and then make a choice. Do you want a diverse team or not? Yeah. But don't block it until you think it through.
So important.
That is so important.
There's so many good points I want to keep going on here, and we're just going to have you back and continue this conversation. But one of the mistakes that you see leaders today making more frequently than other mistakes that you would warn against?
I think leaders today, one of the mistakes that they make is because there's such good information today on leadership, they begin to engage in practices that they truly don't understand the depth of or have empathy or an innate interest in, but they engage in those practices because sort of they are the thing to do in the leadership world today. And that leads to problems down the road because I want to go back to leaders' self-awareness. You know, I had a leader a while back who I asked him to have a focus group, and he said to me, "Oh, you know, it's one of those sessions where I complain. You know, I hate focus groups." And I counseled him on positive intent. I counseled him on, you know, the values. And he said, "Hey, you know what? I think this works. I'm going to do this." And I always had a note taker in my focus group so I could focus on the thing at hand and not having to take notes. So I gave him my note taker, and she called me after that focus group of his. And she said, "Tony, I have to tell you something. This guy during the focus group would ask a question, and as they were given the answer, he'd be looking at his iPhone. And then I got it. He was going
Wrong
through
signal.
The motions of a leader
yes.
without having really the commitment to that leader. Leaders have to care about what they do. They genuinely have to care. So I would rather a leader not do something, then do it and not care.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of leaders today and managers, young managers, that are doing things because it's expected, it's what they have to do, it's what they need to do to succeed. And you could see it. They're not as good as the others. You know, it's funny, like
so
most things in life, leadership is what you make of it. It's a privilege to be a leader. It really is. And
it's a responsibility and it's such a privilege. I so agree with that.
And what I say to people is if you get that gift, that ability to lead, protect it, grow it, perfect it, and really become the leader who's within you. But if you don't nurture leadership, if you're not thinking about it all the time, you're not going to grow as a leader.
Yeah.
I'm retired now, 62 years old, and I'm still thinking of ways to be a better leader.
I love it. It's so important that we analyze that. And I think it really starts by knowing yourself. And you can so quickly tell when someone is taking another person's playbook. And that's fine for a period of time. If you're learning a sport, learn how someone does it that's successful at it. I get that. You know, imitating a successful leader is fine. But you quickly need to find your personality, your focus, and how you're going to manifest the leadership in your community. And I think then that's what's so authentic. And I think you have learned to do that so well. Which really brings me to my next point is if you were giving advice, and you are now, you're going to be coaching a lot of leaders, and how would you say to future leaders the things that they need to do that better position them for that first leadership position? You talked about being there, being present. That's one of them. What's some other things?
Well, I think I'll go back to a couple of things that I think are critical for young leaders today. The first thing is to remember something about yourself that is key, and that is everywhere you go, you show up. So you could take somebody else's playbook. You could take some advice from someone, and you could go put it into the workforce or put it into your everyday social life. But the reality is you'll show up eventually. So the key is to becoming authentic, is to think about and internalize and accept the values that you're going to portray as a leader. Yep. That's the first and foremost thing I tell people. Is be true to yourself, because yourself will come out. That's just the bottom line on that. The second thing I really think is key is my mantra of what you think about, you talk about, and you bring about, all towards sort of a true north. Understand what your goal is, and then every time you think of it in the context of what you're trying to get established. Think of how it affects people. You know, I often tell a story of when I was the CEO at Saxon. To get to my office, I had to walk past our call center. And on the front row of the cubicles of the call center were all, call agents. And I'd walk by them every morning. And when I walked by, I'd say good morning to every single call agent. And you say, that's a great thing. But let me tell you something about that. One day, as I was coming to the last of the row, I noticed that they had literally moved the door over the weekend about 4 feet to the left because they were putting in some more space, and it distracted me. And I walked right by the last person that was on that. I went into my office and I started my day, and my HR director came in. She said to me, she said, hey, Tony, I got a question for you. She said, do you have a problem with Maria? And I said, no, I said, I don't even know Maria. I said, I just see her like every morning. Why would I have a problem with her? She said, well, she's devastated. And I said, devastated? And she said, yeah, she's devastated because this morning you said hello to every call agent except her. And that's one of those moments right there. You could tell her to get a life. Or you could say, wait a second, that's being the leader in the moment, right? I wasted a leadership moment inadvertently right there.
Yeah.
So I said to her, well, let me go out. She goes, no. Don't go out there and make a big, that's not how you're going to repair things. She said, tomorrow morning, when you walk by, just let her know. And I said, but she's got to go through the entire day and night. And she said to me, it'll grow her because she'll realize that in a moment's transaction doesn't define who she is. And she said to me, and really looking at you right now, I know it's growing you. So great advice, right? Great advice. That's what I mean about you always have to be aware that you're a leader. And if you want to create an environment that is approachable, that is open, that is collaborative, then you better make sure you include everybody in every moment, because if you don't, you're going to lose some people, and that's not what you're trying to do.
Well, I mean, there's so many stories in each one of these stories you've told us. I could just go on and on about, but I mean, just because we all do this reactive thing, oh no, I want to make it right, and you jump out and try to make something right. And in actuality, you may actually exacerbate the problem that you first created. So there was wisdom in it. And the best word she said to you, the head of HR, was, you're growing in it and she's going to grow in it. And I think sometimes we just have to grow in our mistakes. And I think that's so good. Oh, Tony, I could have this conversation go on all day. I'm so excited that Cindy, when we were together recently, just went on and on and raved about you. I now know why. I have deeper insights. I'm so excited about this. Let's wrap it up with this. What are some resources that you would recommend someone use to gain insights into becoming a better leader? What do you personally recommend?
Well, there's a couple of things. I study leaders. So I read a lot of books on leaders, and really to try articles online just to see what leaders are talking about, what leaders are doing. And those things that I like about those articles and books, I tend to write down and think about of how would I incorporate these into my style. I buy into them because that's what I write them down. So, well, this is really a good way to look at this. I like the way this is going. And then I try to, you know, look at some of that. But one of the things that I really do quite a bit of is I reflect on the day's activities. And I know it sounds, you know,
do it every day. Yeah.
Cliche, but I literally sit there at the end of a day and say to myself, you know, what did I learn? And in the mornings, I look at my calendar and I live that calendar in my mind, each meeting. What opportunity am I going to have in this meeting to get my mantra out as a leader, to align people? What things are going to be challenges for me in this set of meetings today? How will these go down? And it's funny because after a budget presentation a number of years ago, my boss said to me, my God, Tony, he said, it was like you did that before. And I looked at him. I said, I did. I did about 10 times before. I thought it through. I thought about the questions. Who was going to ask what? Who would be upset with one of the things we were going to cut in the budget? Who would be enamored with it? How do you align? What you think about, you really bring about if you really,
yeah.
People do not, it's terrible to say, but people really don't think. I'll just give you one quick example to resonate with your viewership here. And that's this. You all have a staff meeting. Everybody has a either they go to it or they have it. That's all I'll say about staff meetings. But here's the question I've got. How do you prepare for a staff meeting? And you know, David, what I'm told, but people, I don't prepare. I just go. Think about that moment. You're there amongst your colleagues and peers with your boss talking about the things that are going to steer your company's direction, that are going to make a difference in your employees' lives, and you didn't think about it? I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how crazy that sounds. But those are the types of things that people don't, you know, they don't prepare for. And preparation breeds confidence and understanding, you know? And
yeah.
So I would tell people, you know, prepare. Everybody's enamored with preparation when it gets on the stage. You know, the Super Bowl. Bill Belichick has prepared the Patriots again, you know. But nobody prepares. If you're enamored with it, write it down, preparation.
Do it. Yeah.
Think about what it means to you, how you could perfect it in your own way, and then do it. And I guarantee you, if your listeners would just take preparation and positive intent, just those two things, and incorporate them into their everyday activities in a way that they understand them, study them, perfect them, internalize them. Within a year, they will be leaps and bounds better leaders, guaranteed.
That is so good. There's so much in everything you said. Every statement, every moment of this interview has just been loaded, saturated with so much content. It is truly a concentrated package. They talk about this concentrated drink. Well, this has been a concentrated interview. You need us, the listeners, you got to download this, listen to it, share it, bring it into your management meetings, talk about it. And then you have the privilege now of retaining Tony as a coach. So let's talk about your coaching as we wrap this up. I got a feeling you're going to get a lot of business off of this interview. Talk about your goals are. You're now retired from Bank of America, are you fully retired now, or just about ready to become retired?
I'm fully retired.
Excellent. So, well, congratulations. I've tried that several times. I failed at retirement. I just want to stay out doing things. But yeah, you are going to stay doing things. So talk about the coaching. How are you going to go about it? Go ahead.
Yeah, retirement. Let me just say a word about retirement for folks to think about that. You know, if you think about a pie chart of your existence in life, you know, in the corporate world or in the business world, you wind up with that pie chart and you do things because you need to do them. You do things because you have to do them.
Right.
And you do things then because you simply just want to do them. And there's nothing wrong, by the way, with those three buckets. You know, you need to, you know, if you're going to be a Bank of America executive, you need to be in Boston, Charlotte, or New York. You know, that's where the big executive headquarters are. So that's a need, right? I wouldn't necessarily live in one of those three towns if I could choose, but I would need to be there if I was an executive with a company that was located in those three towns as for their executives. That's a need example. A have example is, look, you know, there are meetings you have to go to. You know, you have to go to your boss's staff meeting. you have to. It's by protocol. You're expected. But then there's those things that you just want to do. So retirement is nothing more than eliminating the need and haves and doing only the wants. That's all retirement is.
So for me, retirement,
if I go back to why I exist, help people achieve their goals, I have some senior advisory work that I do. So I advise some CEOs on how to get from point A to point B based on my experiences. I have some boards that I'm on because I enjoy, particularly new companies attract me because I want to build something. I want to help those people succeed and become a great company. And then there's coaching. And it's helping people achieve their goals. So I start out with people by defining their goals. And, you know, it's funny, that's not an easy process. If you're really looking for your true north, if you really want to define your goals in life, your personal goals, your business goals, and how those two complement each other, it's difficult. So we go through a period of doing that. Then we go through a period of saying, so if these are the goals you want to accomplish, what are the things you have to really be good at? And what are the vulnerabilities that could sink you in that? And then we work on those. And then it's interactive from there. So it's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. I really do. And I just can't tell you the satisfaction I get out of seeing someone I'm coaching do well or get promoted or complete a project successfully. It's a rush. It's great.
How can people get a hold of you, Tony, that are interested in your coaching skills or just want to follow up? I know some more interviews are going to come out of this interview for other podcasters when they listen to it. How can they get a hold of you?
I think the easiest way is through LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest way for people. Everybody who's on LinkedIn could just go on, and they could also get a hold of me, you know, through you, or they could get a hold of me, you know, again, even in an indirect email if they like. My email is atmiola@gmail.com. So, you know, they could do that. But you know, having just retired recently, you know, I haven't set up any websites or any of that stuff.
Good. That is so good, Tony. Thank you so much for taking time. I am looking forward to the continued influence you have on the industry. You've been so successful, and we're just thrilled. I want to say a special shout out to Cindy Smaney at Freedom Mortgage for being really calling again attention. I've heard of you. I've heard about your management style, but really she just went on and on and raved about you. So, Cindy, thank you very much. Thank you, Tony, for being here, and I look forward to talking to you more.
Thanks, David. Best of luck to you. Take care.